I wanted to talk to you today about, in a sense, work that is coming out of the work on European geopolitics, but that I've been doing more recently, that has to do specifically with European borders and European border management, or this idea of European border management, because it's very much part of the ways in which the EU projects itself in the world, especially in its immediate neighborhood, and the ways in which it constitutes itself as a very particular sort of geopolitical actor. I've come to this, as I said, mostly through my work on European geopolitics and trying to identify what is it that makes Europe a geopolitical actor. How does it express its what it sees as its distinctive nature as a world actor, and kept coming back to the question of borders. I mean, I'll say this immediately, I'm not an expert on borders, I don't do work on migration, so take what I say from the perspective of a political geographer, of somebody who does, if I do anything, I do geopolitics, okay? But increasingly I found it impossible to write about European geopolitics, about EU geopolitics, I should say, without focusing on borders and border work and the EU's border work. Especially because it has become clear in recent years, and numerous scholars have commented on this, that in the constitution of particular sorts of borders, in managing borders in particular, and I'll say something more about this idea of border management, that's where what French political theorist Zakilaidi calls the aesthetics of European power become apparent. Also because the borders of Europe are not just no longer only the confines of the EU, okay? They extend far beyond those confines. Etienne Balibar, but also others, also here at the Open University, several colleagues in politics, the door just refused. We can leave it open, there isn't much to do. No border. including actually some colleagues here in politics at the OU have been doing some very interesting work looking at the ways in which borders are being debordered or rebordered, whatever term you want to use, the ways in which borders are being stretched to move beyond kind of the territorial confine and stretch both inside the national territory but also far beyond it. So, you know, beyond that set of considerations, my preoccupation was in somehow trying to catch the sites, the places, the ways in which European power, if you want to call it geopolitical power, expresses itself, and going beyond the European trompe l'oeil, as Pierre Bourdieu called it some time ago, the fact that we can't really catch, really put completely our hands on what Europe actually does and where it does it. And this is partially to do with the constitution of Europe, and I mean the EU now, as a geopolitical subject, but as an institutional subject. And the fact that this border work, especially, is proceeding in various sites and through various proxies as well. Okay? It's proceeding not only through institutional means, through particular actors, but also through the diffusion of norms, standards, and I'll talk about that again when I talk about this idea of border management. So what began to interest me is this idea of border work as a particular geopolitical technology. And the term border work is not of my own invention, but actually belongs to a colleague of mine at Royal Holloway, Chris Rumford, who's a political sociologist. And he has written extensively about this idea of border work, of making borders, literally, the technology of border making. Now, I'll see if I can make this flash file work. Many of the points that I will raise today don't, of course, only pertain to Europe. This debordering of borders, both beyond the national territory and within the national territory, this has been taking place elsewhere in the world. I mean, if you look in the North American context, the fact of, you know, kind of moving the border away from the border itself, whether into Canada or Mexico or to various kind of proxy agencies, consulates and so on, that has been taking place for quite a while. Also this idea of moving borders within the territory. This is a map that you may be familiar with. A few years ago, an artist collective in Switzerland called MIGMAP produced this virtual cartography of European borders. And this beautiful set of maps aimed at capturing, you know, what European bordering practices, border work is like, especially in where it is. And I liked this one. This is a wonderful kind of depiction of Europe's real borders, because they highlight the various places where borders are made and enforced, from schools to registration of flats, railway stations, media, TV, metros. I'll see if I can click on this, because in theory, let's see if this works. No, it doesn't come up with the story. They're linked to particular stories. So the story for the railway station, actually, they linked it up to various research projects on borders. I'll tell you one other story that's not linked to this, work of a German colleague who worked with various West African migrant communities in Germany. Story recounted to her of one person who goes with his German friend to the railway station to buy a ticket to Paris and is asked for his passport. You know, suddenly, magically, at the railway station, the border materializes in the office of the ticket controller. For this particular person, of course, and you know, you can take it to the streets, to the schools. In Italy, for example, with the criminalization of illegal migration since last year, basically teachers, just as health workers, are being asked to ascertain the legality of people coming, whether it is to the first aid center or to the school, and they're supposed to denounce them. Okay. Let's see if we can click away from this. Now it's stuck. So this is what you get for going multimedia. Okay. All right. Beyond these kind of general considerations, what I want to do today is focus on two ways in which EU does its border work and how it's linked to a broader kind of constitution of itself as a geopolitical subject. I want to talk to you about this idea of securing the external and the role of the European Neighbourhood Programme in securing the neighbourhood. Okay? And I'll give you the example of the UBAM mission in Moldova, which is seen, held up as a kind of model actor in this idea of remote control borders and in how non-European states learn European rules. Okay? And secondly, I want to talk to you about the operations of Frontex, which is the European Agency for the Control and Coordination of External Borders, and the variety of new offshore solutions that are being used to control Europe's Mediterranean frontier. In particular, I'll talk to you about Libya, which is, to my mind, the most interesting case right now of offshore outsourced migration management, the most problematic, certainly. And again, actually, there are colleagues here in politics, Rudvica Andreasevich, and I think a couple of other people who are working precisely on this question. So I'm sorry that they can't be here. I mean, I've been in correspondence with them, but I'm aware that there are people here who are doing very interesting work on these questions. Okay, so let's start with this idea of securing the external. Because I think this is a very important part of how border work becomes a very important geopolitical technology. Now, the European Union's work in its neighbourhood, its kind of policies towards its neighbourhood, have been transformed in recent years towards a kind of progressive securitization of these policies, originally intended as policies aimed at the kind of democratization and all sorts of good things like that, and especially kind of economic incorporation, the fostering of ties. The ENP, the European Neighbourhood Programme, has progressively become a tool in stabilization and securitization. And the Western Balkans, the Balkans in general, have become a very important site for that, and also a site where to deploy Europe's lessons in bordering. Now, my co-national, Jan Zielonka, calls it empire by example, and I think it's a very apt term. The ways in which the Western Balkans, of course not only, have been progressively incorporated into the European space has been specifically through the export of regulatory regimes. Okay? What he says is, he calls the creation of semi-protectorates whose sovereignty is not denied but creatively constrained. And the very interesting thing here is the ways in which this process works, the kind of dialectical relation that is established where these states not only willingly participate in this process, it is, you know, if you read the ENP kind of documentation, it is governments, local governments, that ask for Europe's expert advice, that, you know, adapt legal norms, that adapt other economic regulations, etc., etc. And this idea of empire by example is very powerful. What Sri Lanka says is that the Union legitimizes its strategies, as again in the Balkans or elsewhere, not by the idea of might is right, and you know, this is presumably the distinction from the United States model, okay, but rather by claiming that its norms are right. And these norms are incredibly powerful, also in constituting new border regimes. Okay, Kosovo, I think, is a perfect example. I mean, I presume all of you are familiar more or less with the process in which Kosovo declared its independence, or was guided to independence, we should say, okay, and the role of international actors in this process, okay, the EU, okay, EU institutions, but not only, of course, the United States were a very important actor, and actually transpired literally guiding EU directives, and kind of this famous memo leaked by a Slovenian newspaper saying that the American ambassador was giving directions to the EU mission on when to declare independence and in what fashion. So this idea that somehow this was the EU pushing this is a rather problematic story. But the idea, if you remember, these are pictures from the Associated Press of the days before independence in Pristina. American, British flags saying thank you to the international community for supporting it, but also European flags flying on the streets. Okay. Since independence, forget the whole debate about EU's role in guiding the independence. EU institutions have been very important in literally state making in Kosovo. The EU mission called ULEX that was sent in following independence to not replace UNMIC, which is the UN mission, the peacekeeping mission, but to accompany it, was literally, the remit of the mission was pacification, stabilization, and normalization. Normalization literally in, not only the sense of normalizing, pacifying, but literally incorporating Kosovo into the European kind of legal regulatory space. Okay. The ULEX mission that goes into Kosovo, that is there currently, as you saw from the graffiti on Vuhan Pristina, not really well taken to. In fact, the mission had been attacked on numerous occasions. The ULEX mission was not a military mission. This was police personnel, legal experts, civil servants, and most of all, borders and customs officials. Lots of money poured into Kosovo, 5 billion euros since 1999. And the aims of the mission was literally to integrate this new state into the regulatory regime prepared for the Stabilization Association Agreement, which is the first step for kind of integration into European structures, create new visa regimes, so being able to control flows of people, and to establish new customs regulations, working towards a customs union with Albania. Why the EU should be interested in building a customs union with Albania is an interesting story, but especially incorporating Kosovo into the European legal and economic space. Okay? The question of borders has always been a very important one. This is a map that comes actually from a popular Italian geopolitical magazine called Limes, okay, geopolitical, National Geographic, let's say. And it was wonderful because it calls Kosovo the Kosovo Armory. Okay, and you can see it here punctured by all kinds of illicit flows of arms going in all sorts of directions. Okay, so this idea that this space not only had to be constituted as a state, but especially its flows, various problematic flows that were passing through its territory, had to be controlled, normalized, constrained, somehow incorporated into the European border regime. Okay. Now, the Balkans, as I said, are just one example of this, because the European Neighborhood Programme, its preoccupation, has not only been with the Balkans, but with securing and somehow normalizing the broader European neighborhood. And as in the Balkans, the preoccupation has shifted from neighborhood policy in terms of yes, economic assistance, economic incorporation, promotion of civil human rights, etc., etc., to the question of policing flows. Okay, so this idea of European neighbours as buffers and literally as policemen of flows before they reach Europe's boundaries. So Sandra Lavinex, for example, talks about the important ways in which neighbours have become a way of externalizing European governance, okay? The way in which Europe has somehow passed on to them part of the task of securing Europe's borders. Okay? The aim of the ENP when it was launched in 2003 was, quote, promoting stability and prosperity within and beyond the new borders of the Union, certainly very clearly a neoliberal agenda. But what has happened to it in the past years is that it has taken on an explicitly security focus. There was a report by the European Court of Auditors literally a few months back, noting that over 90% of all the ENP funds were spent on border work, on border control mechanisms, on training of border and customs officials, and so on. So, far from this idea of promoting stability and prosperity. The ENP program, sorry, this is a terrible map. This is probably what I get of trying to get it off illegally off an EU website without proper acknowledgements. Are these kind of ring of green countries? Okay, and of course also the Balkans and Turkey. As you can see, the European neighbourhood stretches not only to the southern shores of the Mediterranean, but also to parts of Central Asia. Okay, and as I said, over the past years, this course of securing the external and using the ENP to do precisely that has translated itself into actually concrete interventions in border management. The EU now has missions, direct missions or partial missions in all of these places, all across the Balkans. So there are EU monitors, EU kind of various training facilities in Bosnia and Serbia and Croatia and Montenegro and Kosovo. It's working in Morocco and Libya and Senegal, also in Gaza, although that mission has been suspended, and Moldova and the Ukraine. Okay, and this is in one of, as I said, the examples that I want to bring to you, because the European mission in Moldova is seen very much as a kind of model of what the EU does in its neighbourhood, and the benefits, okay, of its border work, not only for Europe itself, but for its ring of friends, its neighbourhood. The pictures that you see here are from the launch of the mission. You see Javier Solana, formerly the EU's chief diplomat, if you can call him that, announcing the launch of the mission. Now, Moldova is an interesting case because it has, I presume all of you know where Moldova is. I give it as a kind of trick question to my third year course on Europe, and nobody can identify. They see it, they place it in all sorts of locations. Okay, not a place most people know much about, but seen as a particularly dangerous kind of hotspot for the traffic of all sorts of illegal goods, from people smuggling to organ smuggling, tobacco, drugs, counterfeit products, etc., etc. Okay, and that's the focus. Since Moldova is not part of the EU, of course, the EU cannot send its own kind of border guards to guard Moldova's borders. So the aim of the mission was to provide assistance. And in fact, EUBAM is the European Union mission, border assistance mission to Moldova and the Ukraine. Okay? And the word assistance is an interesting one. The formal role of the mission is to, quote, observe, advise, and assist efforts to facilitate trade and legal mobility and counteract illegal activities using improved analytical tools and risk management, which is, of course, what Europe can offer to these, lesser developed states in the East who are not properly able to filter their borders, who are not properly able to manage these flows. And by management of flows means letting the right ones through and stopping the those considered problematic. Part of the EUBAM's discourse, and there are a couple of people who have been doing great work on this, is this idea of the rule of experts or the rule of standards and how European experts somehow kind of convey their knowledge and allow these countries to become part of the European normative space. The UBAM mission has also been seen as a great example of what's been called the remote control border, you know, remotely controlled from Europe, with, you know, kind of the border control actions, of course, exercised by other others on the ground. But especially, and this is, you know, what I wanted to bring to you today, it has been seen by the EU itself as the perfect example of a new sort of border management. I'll show you a short video clip that comes off the website of the EU's Directorate for External Affairs, and it is seen as, you know, it is shown as the best example of the EU's global approach to border management. You will hear this quote in the video, but I thought I'd bring it to you here because I think this is kind of the key point. Speaking about, I think, you know, Romanian and Ukrainian border guards, the UBAM advisor says, well, you know, they still see their job as guarding borders. They are border guards. This is, you know, this is passé. But we guide them towards the idea of border management. Managing a border means guarding when and where required. Okay, so this ability to control flows in particular ways. And now let's see if I can get this to work. No? Aha. See, I thought I was... This is what I get for... I did test this out before.
It's not our machine.
It's not your machine, it's my machine. In fact, I insisted on bringing my machine precisely because of this. There is another way I can do it. I've actually saved it on my desktop knowing that problems happen. So...
Not just Postgres.
Okay, the only problem is voice. I hear it coming from somewhere, so it's just a question of adjusting my volume. This is on full. It's coming out of here. Does anybody know?
But the computer volume might not be up, so.
This is on full.
No, not the program, the actual computer. Does that need to be?
Yeah, not
yeah, that's wait, on full yeah. volume as well.
Okay. External landing.
Oh, yeah.
The
thank you.
One
you.
Has many points of entry.
Okay, hold on. Let me take this
back. Odessa, Ukraine. From here and elsewhere, every year 1.6 million migrants make their way to the European Union, which makes immigration the main source of population growth, much more than the difference between births and deaths in the EU. And as Europe is growing older, immigration is vital to make up the shortage of manpower, to increase cultural diversity and stimulate growth. But alongside legal migration, illegal migration can go hand in hand with criminal or illicit activity.
I'm not sorry.
Is migration a good or a bad thing for Europe? With its vast external land border, the European Union has many points of entry. One of the main ones is the route from the east, and it's here that the European
Union... Do you recognise these sorts of maps?
...approach to migration, a comprehensive approach also used in the south with Africa. So how does it work? The objectives of the new strategy are to promote legal migration channels, to prevent illegal immigration, and to maximise the positive effects of migration on the development of the country of origin. And this is being done in close partnership with countries of origin and transit. Until now, this is what has happened. This is the small border town of Chop in Ukraine. From here, it's easy to reach four European countries, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia and Poland, through forests or over the mountains. Although very often the journey for illegal migrants stops here in this sort of reception centre.
Найбільше кількість мігрантів – Грузія, Молдова, Китай, Афганістан, Пакистан, це Індія, це те, що При них нет никаких документов.
And these centers are very much part of this, you know, kind of
NGOs
outsourced
like
network of migration management.
Support migrants in transit. Washing kits are distributed as well as familiar food and clothing. Among them are people who are fleeing their home country because of conflict or persecution. They can therefore seek asylum. Here they receive protection and legal assistance. Longer-term activities are underway with the national authorities to improve the reception conditions and to look after the migrants and asylum seekers. But it's at an earlier stage that the EU is also putting in place the key elements of its strategy for managing migration flows. Let's go to Odessa to see the scheme in action.
Odessa is the headquarters of the UBAN mission, by the
way. It's daybreak over the port. The headquarters of the European project UBAM is here in Odessa. Its aim is to put in place an integrated border management system at the gates of Europe to facilitate legal mobility while fighting against illegal movements.
Egyik prioritás a misszió tevékenységének segíteni a moldáv és az ukrán hatóságokat, főleg az illegális migráció azonosításában, embercsempészetben, és hát
az ehhez
kapcsolódó bűnügyi vizsgálatok kialakításában, főleg a nemzetközi szintéren.
The European experts deployed in the field have been chosen from all the countries of the European Union. Jean-Pierre Alberelli is one of them.
Nous approchons du poste frontière le plus important de la région entre l'Ukraine et la Moldavie, avec grosso modo 3 millions de passagers par an.
Très concrètement, c'est une mission de conseil et d'assistance à nos collègues ukrainiens et moldaves, afin de les accompagner sur leur chemin vers les standards européens de gestion des frontières. Ils en sont encore au concept de garder une frontière, puisqu'il s'appelle toujours des bords de garance, et nous les accompagnons vers la notion de management des frontières ou gestion des frontières. Manager une frontière, c'est la garder où et quand c'est nécessaire.
At the border post, it's very straightforward. Pedestrians pass through the yellow lanes to be checked. The vehicles are separated by category and examined by the Ukrainian guards. The UBAM experts don't carry out any checks themselves as they don't have executive powers. But here on the ground they can observe and propose techniques and give advice to the border guards. Only the travellers and vehicles given the green light can cross the bridge.
Красная линия у нас обозначает, что здесь на данной местности показывает государственная граница, то есть за этой линии это Украина, за этой линии это уже Республика Молдова. Ну, значит, борьба с нелегальными миграциями это один из основных, скажем так, задач, которые стоят перед государственной пограничной службой. На данном участке у нас есть, как, скажем так, это следование граждан Молдовы с целью
It's incredible because, you know, here is a Ukrainian guard, of course,
but
not an EU guard, you know, who really takes it upon himself, you know, as a kind of
Barrett's
mission to check those, you know, who are entering into
EU. So using international coordination, inquiries are carried out on the ground and an analysis made of areas at risk. We're leaving Ukraine to go to the heart of Moldova and its capital, Chisinau. Here, a large number of people would like to migrate, albeit temporarily. Even if no one is prepared to say as much openly, the advertisements in the street express people's real feelings. So, alongside the efforts deployed against illegal migration, the European approach is also to promote legal migration channels.
I flussi migratori verso l'Unione Europea sono una grandissima opportunità. Il trucco consiste nel gestire questi flussi migratori ed evitare che siano anarchici e da tutto incontrollati.
God forbid, especially anarchic flows to be avoided. All right, I just thought I'd give you a little taste of that because, in a sense, this is the EU's own kind of representation of what it does. And especially, I, you know, as I said, I find interesting this notion of migration management, and not only kind of teaching other countries how to manage migration, getting them to, in a sense, do the job for Europe. Okay. And you know, you saw some of the sites, some of the actors involved in this, from the kind of reception centres, which also become detention centres in most cases, to the network of European advisors that this last person was mentioning. The EU, but not only the EU, has been using organizations people called ILOs, so immigration liaison officers, for quite some time now. These are people located very often in consulates in third countries, in various other organizations that are meant to assess asylum claims, immigration claims in situ, so before the person undertakes the journey to Europe. So this is, you know, one example, but the other example that I wanted to talk to you about, and the one that concerns me most right now, is the Mediterranean and the EU's migration management policies in the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean has long been a kind of privileged site for the EU's kind of experimentation of all sorts of policies, from kind of geopolitical extensions to migration management. It has also become, over the past 10 years, Europe's graveyard. You know, I don't know what sense you get of this in the UK, but if you live in Italy or in Spain, it's enough to open the papers, especially in the summer, to see kind of the extent of this challenge for Europe. Over the past 10 years, I mean, this is what you know, various human rights organizations have reported. At least 10,000 people have died making the journey. This is just what has been documented. Okay, this doesn't count those who have been either lost at sea or who never made it to the coasts of Libya, Tunisia, Morocco to make the journey, who died somewhere in the desert on the way there. Okay, so tremendous, problem. Last year alone, in one particular week, the Italian island of Lampedusa was receiving 2,500 kind of arrivals per day. In 2008, just in the summer, 3 months of the summer, 35,000 people landed on Italian shores. Okay, just to give you a scale of the problem. But you know, beyond this, the Mediterranean, and maybe not only because of this, has become really the kind of the favorite space for the experimentation of new modes of European border management. These are kind of the pictures that you will see certainly on Italian newspapers. Rickety wooden boats, very often actually what are used are not wooden boats, but zodiacs to ferry people quite quickly across the sea, and usually kind of dump them as soon as they get close to shore. I thought I'd show you this cartoon also from a Spanish newspaper that appeared a few years back, saying this beach has been certified with the European Union's blue flag for keeping its waters clean of North African boats, rafts, pateras, are, you know, kind of the boats that are used to make the crossing, and you see two border guards. Of course, you'll know that the European blue flag is used to certify clean beaches in the Mediterranean. Okay? This is a topic that has not escaped, you know, kind of the international press as well. 1st of March, both Time and actually Newsweek ran their front kind of covers, kind of focusing on Europe's immigration problem and how especially southern European countries are failing to tackle it. Okay. It's a very, very important issue for Europe. I presume you will have also seen these maps that have appeared. This is actually from the BBC, but a map compiled from UN and Frontex data, trying to somehow map, you know, kind of the main routes of migration across Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa up to the Mediterranean coasts and then to Europe. This map is actually has become old now. It's a couple of years old, okay, because the routes have changed quite significantly. What you see from it is not only, you know, kind of the main routes, which pass, as you can tell, through the desert, whether the Algerian or the Libyan desert, which tells you something about the kind of crossing these people are making, but it also shows what are marked here in green as EU joint border patrols, Frontex. These are patrols that have been going on since actually 2003. Joint patrols made by, you know, whether it's Libyan or Moroccan or Senegalese or Mauritanian authorities with EU patrol boats, okay, designed to stop some of these flows. Okay, This is a slightly updated map stolen from a Frontex presentation that I had the fortune to attend in February in Warsaw. Okay. And this one shows the kind of detections of illegal border crossings and areas where they're decreasing, where they're increasing. You will see that the most, you know, the focus right now is on the Peloponnese, and that's the area where a lot of the crossings are now focusing, actually coming still from Africa, but also from Central Asia, but substantially decreased around the Tunisian and actually Libyan coast, for reasons that I will tell you about in a second. Also a great decrease around the Canary Islands. Okay. As I said, since 2003, officially since 2005, the EU has been deploying various joint patrols to the coasts of Mauritania, Senegal, and of course Tunisia and Morocco, to try to help these countries stop these flows that they presumably were not able to stop themselves. Apart from, you know, kind of the immediate question that arises of, you know, what are European vessels doing in Senegalese territorial waters, you know, questions of sovereignty, etc., etc., this, in a sense, is just the visible part of the EU's interventions. Okay? And I think this is what I think I find particularly interesting, is that I think a lot, you know, of attention has been focused on kind of the military presence of Italian, British, etc., Spanish vessels in these waters. What is much more problematic are the various other kind of regulatory institutional interventions that have accompanied this. In the case of various African states, it is to do with a number of newly stipulating readmission repatriation agreements, a number of new trade agreements that have as an explicit provision the repatriation of foreign nationals, of their nationals that are in Europe, and also actually tying various economic benefits, trade benefits, to these countries' role in combating illegal migration. So when the Lomé Convention came up for renewal, okay, the Lomé Convention regulates terms of trade between the EU and the African, Caribbean, and Pacific nations, okay, 77 nations. When it came up for renewal in 2000, the EU was very explicit in entering a set of new subclauses into it that specified that these states now have to take, you know, all the steps necessary not only to repatriate those nationals that will find themselves in the EU and pay for that, okay, but that they also have to take an active role in combating illegal migration flows in their territories. Okay. Now, there are no specific retaliatory clauses included in these agreements, but the message was quite clear. So when the Cotonou Agreement, as it now became called, was signed in 2000, so this is already 10 years ago, this was put into place. Okay. Now, The agency regulating, presumably, the control of Europe's external borders is called Frontex, and it wasn't constituted until 2005 officially. So from 2000 on, okay, basically, all of these actions, all of these kind of initial attempts at managing Europe's borders externally, okay, managing kind of the neighborhood space, were done in an almost kind of piecemeal fashion. I mean, one of the things that we talked about beforehand when I spoke to some of the postgrads here was the quiet ways in which the EU goes about its business. This, you know, and this is also what Bourdieu alluded to. He talked about the kind of the European trompe d'oeil, that you don't really see what Europe is doing. And that was very much the case through bilateral agreements, through trade agreements, things not very much to do with migration control, but other means of doing the same thing. When Frontex was established in 2005, it was the first kind of crystallization of a singular agency that was, you know, to do this task. Its seat is in Warsaw, and its, you know, kind of remit, again, this is stolen from Frontex's own presentation, was operational cooperation, risk analyses, training of border guards, research and development. Frontex does not have, I mean, it has its staff in Warsaw, but it doesn't have border guards. There are no European border guards, okay? They coordinate, they set the norms, they teach. And this, you know, idea of kind of expert assistance is very important. I particularly liked what they presented were the kind of the objectives of EU border security, because if you see here at the top, the ultimate aim is safeguarding national and European values and interests. Okay. crime prevention figures, you know, slightly below, international protection, trade facilitation, facilitation of bona fide travel, and enforcement of law and order. And of course, border control is just the means of achieving all these wonderful aims. Okay? And another kind of graphic, this is, you know, great also. What are the aims? Humanity, open communication, professionalism, trustworthiness. Humanity was the one that really struck me. Now, of course, not everybody agrees that this has been Frontex's remit or, you know, actually where its actions have been heading. What you see up here is kind of creative rewriting of Frontex's logo on the building in Warsaw, done by some No Borders activists a couple of years ago, which calls it the Union Deportation Agency and reworks the EU's slogan of Libertas, Securitas, Justicia, as liberty, security, and justice, as slavery, intolerance, and injustice. And this was wonderful. It actually stayed up for almost a week. They couldn't get it off. I think, you know, the interesting thing here with Frontex is not only kind of the constitution of a singular agency that is meant to teach proper border control, very much as in the case of UBAM, but the ways in which it has taken border management to a new level. Now, there are a number of people who've been writing about the increasing militarization of EU border management. A colleague of mine, Nick Vaughan Williams at Exeter, has been doing quite a bit of work on this, use of biometrics, various use of actually military technologies for civilian scope. But what interests me, and this is what I'd like to close with, is how Frontex has increasingly operated a selective stretching of the European space, including a suspension of what are supposed to be European legal norms, the norms that it's supposed to be teaching, that it's supposed to be somehow diffusing. Those norms are increasingly suspended. Okay? To give you a sense of what Frontex does, and you know, also very much the kind of the military focus, this is still from their presentation. Not only the use of vessels, airplanes, helicopters to patrol, especially sea borders, but also mobile detection technology, so radars, various other kind of infrared scanners, mobility detection devices, as you see, that can be deployed in mobile fashion. Okay. The use of, and what I also found interesting is a very kind of almost military kind of language of rapid reaction teams. Here they're called rapid teams, renamed rabbit teams by some people working on it. Maps showing the deployment of these various rabbit exercises, as you see across the European space. Sea border operations that span the Mediterranean. I'm just going to go through these quickly just to give you a sense of these. Various key operations that had been carried out in 2009, the Poseidon one, Canary Islands, the island of Lampedusa and Malta, etc., etc., okay? Including a permanent, what's called the Hammer Hubble, a permanent surveillance kind of operation around the core of Europe that is always in place, okay? That wards against these threats coming from, you know, all quarters, including South America, okay? And the important part of this has increasingly become cooperation with third countries, okay? And this is what I'd like to close with, which is namely the Libyan question, okay? Over the past couple of years, Libya has become a very important partner, a very important agent in controlling migration in the Mediterranean. Okay? Initially through a series of bilateral agreements with Italy, but expanded now to include European institutions as well, it has become a very important site for the outsourcing of migration management and also the processing of asylum claims. Okay? Now, the idea of outsourcing migration management and outsourcing asylum management is not anything new, and nor is it, you know, kind of particular to the Mediterranean. This idea was first presented by none other than Tony Blair in 2002, who suggested that states look at various kind of regional solutions to addressing the refugee and asylum question. What he argued was that it was much better to create solutions in the region that would help avoid, you know, migrants making kind of the perilous journey, and provide sites where their claims would be assessed, as, you know, as it was called, in the region. This very often translated into, you know, what was offshore detention centres, essentially. And they, you know, Australia has been very good at kind of implementing these solutions, but it's not the only example. And, you know, a number of people, including Jennifer Hindman, Alison Mounts, have written about this, so I'm not going to talk about it, because I want to focus on Libya and specifically how it engages with this notion of European border management. Because here again, we come to, you know, kind of the hidden, and I'm not really comfortable with using this word, but I don't know what word to use. The kind of ambiguous nature of European policies in this field. Because here, for example, we talk about mostly bilateral agreements that are doing the job of Europe and for Europe. The first agreements, official agreements, were signed in 2007, and then came the friendship treaty between Libya and Italy in August 2008 that was meant to cancel the colonial past, provide, you know, various economic incentives, and this was, you know, kind of the important goal, admit Libya fully into the kind of family of democratic nations, and it would now play its role in kind of in also in migration management. In 2008, a number of Italian Coast Guard vessels are ceded to Libya and begin to deploy joint patrols. Okay, Italian police guards, border officials go to Libya to train Libyan police and armed forces in appropriate control and search and rescue operations, and all is well. In 2009, okay, Italy begins to implement a new policy. Again, this is completely apart from European legislation in the matter, called its pushback policy. Okay. Since May 2009, and not only, you know, are Libyan vessels supposed to aid in policing, you know, kind of the flows that are taking off from its beaches, but they're actually taking part in bringing those migrants that reach Italian shores back to Libya. This is, you know, actually official specifications from the Ministry of the Interior, saying the ways in which the Guardia di Finanza is a unique kind of Italian police force, which is the tax police, basically, okay, but they're therefore the control of borders as well, and the Navy are in charge of operations. So if the migrants are intercepted between 12 and 24 nautical miles, the Navy will the Guardia di Finanza intervenes. If it's beyond 24 nautical miles, it is the Navy, okay? In theory, if the vessel is intercepted in Italy's territorial waters, which is within 12 nautical miles, the migrants who are intercepted are brought to land where they benefit from the legal and procedural safeguards provided under Italian EU law. Okay. When a vessel is sighted, the Navy or the Guardia di Finanza will supposedly board the vessel, assess who is there, provide first aid, and then the remaining migrants will be returned to Libya directly. So they're not brought on shore. I mean, the prior policy was, you know, whoever made it into Italian territorial waters, or actually even before, would be taken in. They would be taken to one of the kind of reception or detention centres, most notably the one in Lampedusa. Their state of health would be assessed, their asylum kind of rights would be assessed, and, you know, they may then later be expelled, deported, but they would be taken to Italy. They would be brought into the EU. Now, with the pushback policy, they're taken. They're never admitted. Okay, they're literally pushed back. Okay. The EU, the Council of Europe, finally sent a fact-finding mission in July 2009, and the report was recently published. Was published actually at the end of April. Okay. Noting what had been noted already by various activists, journalists, you know, kind of observing the situation, namely that although, you know, there is the claim that, you know, through these operations, you know, migrants are taken on board, and of course their right to asylum is assessed before they're pushed off or pushed back, as the policy says, the authorities actually admitted that they do not proceed with any formal identification with the migrants who are intercepted at sea and pushed back. And this was, you know, this was great, because this is official government statements. They've affirmed that no migrant has ever expressed his or her intention to apply for asylum, and that consequently there's never been a need to identify these persons and establish their nationality. Of course, you know, the Council of Europe report goes on to say that somebody who has just gotten off, you know, probably a three-day voyage with no food and water would not be in the state to affirm that right. There are no interpreters on board, and, you know, this is absolutely impossible. What emerges, and again, this is, you know, something that had already been highlighted over the past couple of years, that there's absolutely no procedure in place capable of referring the migrants for protection mechanisms, or, you know, there's no screening mechanism whatsoever. The Navy and the Coast Guard are in no way responsible for the identification of migrants, the provision of information on how to apply for asylum, or the treatment of asylum requests. Okay. This is, of course, highly problematic. I mean, forget, you know, kind of stopping migration flows. But, you know, in the case of asylum rights, the EU has a specific set of policies. There's the United Nations Convention on Refugee Rights as well, to which, of course, Italy is a signatory. Okay, and, you know, so this is highly problematic. How does Italy get around it? I mean, how was this pushed through? Okay. And it was pushed through in the name of securitization, above all. The forced return of migrants, the Italian government has argued, conforms to this convention against kind of trafficking and organized crime. Okay? So with the kind of idea of the threat of smuggling, you know, that those laws are circumvented, but especially through, as I said, a series of bilateral agreements that regulate relations between Italy and Libya. Okay. Bilateral agreements that allow Libyan vessels to repatriate the migrants, take them in, and deal with them as necessary. Okay. This, of course, violates a number of principles, okay, including this idea of non refoulement, so not, you know, kind of not pushing back, no expelling of refugees. All the states that are signatories to the Convention on the Protection of Refugees are bound not to expel or return any refugees in any manner whatsoever to the frontiers of territories where his or her life or freedom would be threatened on account of his or her race, nationality, membership, etc. Okay? This is applicable to any form of forcible removal. So this is, you know, this goes against, you know, I'm not going to kind of belabor this point because I think it's quite clear. This goes absolutely against all European legislation in the matter. Certainly against the kind of EU's ideals of freedom, security, and justice. Maybe security is somewhere there, okay? But certainly violates all of these points, okay? What is more, and this is, you know, the European Court of Human Rights has expressed itself numerous times over the past couple of years on this, states are responsible not only for the actions of their own institutions, their own border guards in this case, but also they're obliged, you know, to verify that there's no kind of extraterritorial application. So in this case, Italy would be responsible, is held responsible for what third parties, in this case Libya, does. Okay. This, you know, of course, has raised, you know, a number of reactions. Also because over time, the conditions of, you know, these migrants that are being pushed back to Libya are coming out. Now, as I said, Libya is not a signatory to any of the conventions, whether on the rights of refugees, the 1951 Convention, or any, you know, kind of human rights legislation. Most of the migrants are put into detention centers, either at the coast or more frequently in the Libyan desert. Many countries such as Nigeria, Mali are asked to take them back, okay, so they send flights to repatriate them from Libya. Those countries that don't provide such services, the migrants are literally marched to the southern border and abandoned there. And a couple of Italian journalists have just done a service on the brisk trade that has started now for the traffickers, who not only have, you know, gotten money to accompany people to the coast, but are now taking money to accompany them back down through the desert. The most kind of frequent thing that is happening is, of course, these people who haven't, of course, made it to Europe are completely without money, okay? So they're very often literally stranded. The map that I showed you there's a town in Niger called Agadez, which has become kind of the central nerve point for these flows. And there are apparently thousands and thousands of migrants who have been expelled from Libya or have never made it across the desert, who are literally, they're called ghosts in this town, stuck there, unable to go home, unable certainly to make it to Europe. Okay? So this is one of the kind of the results of this. This is a statement that was released at the end of February by the EU Office of Amnesty International and a number of other organizations, finally kind of bringing public attention to this, to the, you know, the effects that the externalization of the EU's border management is having, and arguing that member states' obligations under international European law can't possibly stop at the boundaries of the EU. This responsibility is not only moral and political, but also legal. Okay. I know I've got a couple of minutes now. So beyond this, and I think here, I think for me as a political geographer, there are kind of huge issues on how bilateral agreements are used to circumvent EU legislation and the kind of coexistence of various kind of levels of policymaking. There is something more to this. When Frontex sent its first border assistance mission to Libya in 2007, it came to a set of very kind of interesting conclusions, very geographical. Synthesizing here, it said, well, you know, Libya, this is not, you know, the usual kind of green border. It can't possibly patrol it, control it, respecting, you know, the norms that we would expect. We need new mechanisms, new standards, new forms of control. The solution, just recently announced, walls are in vogue across the world. Okay, this one will be an electronic wall. There will be the EU is funding 50%, the EU 50%, the Italian government, a new security barrier. That's the term that is used along Libya's southern borders with Sudan, Chad, and Niger. €300 million. Curiously enough, the bid went to Selex, which is an Italian company, which is actually a subsidiary of Finmeccanica, which is a governmental company. It's owned, actually partially owned by the Ministry of the Economy. The bid went out in 2009. If you go on the Selex side, Selex actually does homeland security solutions for the UK and the US as well. It's a great website. It's amazing because you can see all this stuff, you know, online. They're very proud of displaying it. Okay. And this is the way they present the bid. There is going to be an operational center, okay, being able to monitor flows with GIS remote sensing and a variety of mobile technologies. These are actually containers that can be moved on trucks for kind of mobile detection devices. As well as this was my favorite, drones kind of that will monitor the border. They're called Electra Twin Flyers. And, you know, these will be kind of deployed along Libya's southern borders. Now, you know, I mean, we can make all kinds of comments here regarding, you know, kind of economic interests, Italian companies, Eni, which is the big gas petroleum company, has huge interest in Libya. There is an increasing interpenetration of Libyan Italian interests. Unicredito, which is one of the two major Italian banks, now has a very important Libyan stakeholder. But by way of thanks, the EU just announced May 11th, so about a week ago, that it will open the first proceedings of the association agreements with Libya. So from pariah state, Libya has now managed, through its kind of willing participation in border management, it's will be able to hopefully achieve the first step in a kind of rapprochement, certainly in economic terms, with the EU. I know I'm out of time, so I will leave the kind of deep theoretical points. I'll leave you to tease those out because I've gone way over my allotted time. So thank you, and I'll be looking forward to your comments.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.